Welcome to the Prophet University audio series. Here are your hosts, Bill Kennard and Tom Grandy.
Welcome to the Prophet University audio series. I'm Bill Kennard, along with our company's founder, Tom Grandy. This month's program is titled, Finding and Fixing the Profit-Killing Hidden Costs in Your Business. Tom, with your industrial engineering background, I'll bet you really enjoyed this presentation.
I sure did, Bill. I mean, as an industrial engineer, the entire educational focus is on how to do the job faster, more efficiently, at the least possible expense. And that's just what our speaker is sharing about. Dick talks about putting processes into the business to make it more efficient, and then using those processes to evaluate weaknesses to improve quality and profitability.
Oh, you're right, Tom. You know, I really liked his five whys. This was a process of continuously asking why until it eventually comes back to the root cause. Then the process can be corrected and efficiency improved. This month's presenter is Dick Kornbluth. Dick and his partners started Entherm Inc., a retrofit insulation company in Syracuse, New York in 1980. Entherm was the first company recruited into New York State Research and Development Authority's Home Performance with Energy Star program in 2001. Entherm won NYSERDA's Outstanding Achievement in Home Performance Contracting Award every year it was given between 2002 and 2006. In 2007, Dick received the Building Performance Institute's first Outstanding Achievement in Building Performance Award. In May 2006, Dick and his partner sold Entherm, Inc. to Green Homes America. Dick remained on as the management team of Green Homes until August 2010, when he left to start his own consulting business, Dick Kornbluth, LLC. He currently serves on the boards of the Building Performance Association, where he is the board chair. And now, with finding and fixing the profit-killing hidden costs in your business, here is Dick Kornbluth with this month's Profit University audio series presentation.
The principles of quality management have been around for at least 700 years. In the late 13th century in Europe, craftsmen began organizing into unions called guilds. These guilds were responsible for developing strict rules for product and service quality, and they established clear, measurable standards. The guilds formed inspection committees to enforce the rules. Products or services that met the high standards were identified with a mark or symbol. The system was dominant until the Industrial Revolution in the early 19th century, where the use of factories forced craftsmen to become factory workers and shop owners to become production supervisors. Quality in the system was assured through the skill of the laborers, supplemented by audits and inspections. In the late 19th century in the United States, a new management approach was adopted that focused more on productivity than quality. This approach was developed by Frederick W. Taylor, whose goal was to increase productivity without increasing the number of skilled craftsmen. He achieved this by assigning factory planning to specialized engineers and using craftsmen supervisors as inspectors and managers who executed the engineers' plans. Productivity increased dramatically, but quality declined. The response of factory managers was to create inspection departments whose job was to catch defective products before they reached the market. But the focus was on the product, not the process that produced the product. In the 1920s, an American engineer and statistician, Walter Shewhart, changed the focus of quality management in business operations. Instead of focusing on the final products, he focused on the processes that controlled the business operations. He noticed that there was always variation in manufacturing processes. Products did not always get manufactured in the exact same time, and there was variation in the finished products themselves. He also noticed that some variation in manufacturing processes was normal, and other variation was not, and was caused by chance or human error. His goal was to reduce or eliminate the variation due to human error, and he created a method of measuring variation, which is still in use today, called statistical quality control. His method employed the use of statistics to determine when variation was within the range of predictable normal variation and when it wasn't. During World War II, when American manufacturing was totally focused on producing the military equipment and munitions necessary to win the war, there was no margin of error allowed, since defective equipment and munitions could cost lives and even potentially the outcome of the war. Schuchart's statistical quality control methods were used to ensure the quality of the military goods that were manufactured. After the war, U.S. manufacturing went back to the old ways of putting quantity over quality. An American engineer, W. Edwards Deming, became frustrated with the abandonment of statistical quality control by U.S. manufacturers. He also saw that the assembly line mentality of the American manufacturing system, which treated workers as extensions of machines, destroyed the self-esteem of the worker. Quote, "People are entitled to self-esteem," he once said. "Our system crushes it out." He believed that management was to blame if workers were not motivated to work well, and that workers should be treated as associates, not hired hands. His ideas found a more receptive audience in Japan, in part because his ideas dovetailed with so many of Japan's own traditions. Japan had long held that hard work and quality craftsmanship were important virtues. Deming also believed it was more important to minimize waste than to focus on the price tag for materials. That meant finding a single supplier for a washer nozzle, for example, and building a long-term relationship with the supplier. He went to Japan and helped it transition from a military-based economy to a consumer-based economy. Japanese manufacturers went beyond statistical quality control and created a new total quality approach. Instead of relying purely on product inspection, they focused on improving all organizational processes through the people who use them. As a result, Japan was able to produce higher quality exports at lower price points, benefiting consumers throughout the world. By 1980, Japanese auto production surpassed U.S. auto production, and Japan became the world's largest producer of automobiles. At first, U.S. manufacturers held to the notion that they were losing out to Japan strictly on price, and the initial U.S. response was to lower costs in order to lower prices to compete with Japanese goods. However, lower costs did not include increased quality, and this did nothing to improve American competitiveness. Eventually, a quality movement developed in the United States. There are now several different approaches to quality management, including total quality management, ISO 9001, Six Sigma, and the Baldrige National Quality Program. They all focus on process and the whole organization and not just on the product. So the term quality I will be talking about in this podcast will be in the context of business operations and quality management, not in the context of the everyday use of the term. I will not be talking about quality in the ordinary language use of the term as something I judge to be desirable or that I like. In the context of quality management, quality will refer to something that can be measured and quantified, so you'll be able to know when your business has achieved quality. In the modern quality management movement, there have been two approaches to quality: quality from a customer's perspective and quality from the manufacturer or service company perspective. Quality from the customer's perspective means that the product or service satisfies a customer's implied or stated needs. In other words, it's a product or service that the customer wants, and it does the job the customer wants it to do. It meets or exceeds the customer's expectations. Or, in the words of Peter Drucker, the most famous management consultant and educator of the 20th century, quote, "Quality in a product or service is not what the supplier puts in, it is what the customer gets out and is willing to pay for," unquote. The most prominent proponent of quality from the customer's perspective was Joseph Juran, who in his seminal book Quality Control Handbook, published in 1951, defined quality as fitness for use. An example of an actual product that lacked quality from the customer's standpoint was Watermelon Oreos, which actually appeared on grocery shelves briefly in 2013. One of the most famous examples of a quality disaster was the rollout of New Coke in 1985. Within months after it entered the market, it was yanked and replaced with Coke Classic, the old Coke that the public wanted. Quality from the manufacturer's perspective is a product or service that is free of defects. It performs or is delivered exactly as it is designed to do. One of the leading exponents of this definition of quality was Philip Crosby, who defined quality in his 1979 book Quality is Free as, quote, conformance to requirements, unquote. Crosby's approach emphasized zero defects and encompassed quality both from the manufacturer's and from the customer's point of view. Everyone would probably agree that a Mercedes-Benz S-Class sedan is a quality car. But how about a Ford Escort? Actually, if the Ford Escort is made to the exact specifications that Ford has developed and performs exactly as specified, it's also a quality car. Whether consumers want it or not is a separate question. A famous recent example of a product with poor quality under this definition is the Boeing 737 MAX. It clearly met the first definition of quality. It was in high demand, but tragically failed the second. The definition of quality that I will use combines both approaches and is the definition promoted by the American Society for Quality. They define quality as, quote, the characteristic of a product or service that bears on its ability to satisfy stated or implied needs and is free of deficiencies. In other words, a product or service is a quality product or service if it meets or exceeds my expectations and is made or delivered to me without any problems. It's important to note that under this definition, quality does not apply only to production. It applies to everything that goes on in your organizations. If the person who answers your phone does not treat the caller with professionalism and respect, that is a quality issue. If contracts are not processed in a timely way, that is a quality issue. If you have issues getting bills out in a timely way, that is a quality issue. If you have callbacks, there is a quality issue in your company. Why does quality matter? It matters because it has a direct effect on the bottom line of your business. There's always a cost associated with poor quality. Let me give you an example from my industry, retrofit insulation. Let's say that while my crew was prepping an attic for insulation, one of the technicians stepped off a joist and onto a sheetrock ceiling, causing a large crack to appear in the ceiling below. This necessitates a return visit to repair and repaint the ceiling. In addition to the direct cost of the callback, which will lower the gross profit on the job, every minute spent on the callback is a minute spent not generating new revenue. I created a spreadsheet to calculate the effect on gross profit of callbacks. What it showed was if I had callbacks on 5% of my jobs, and each callback required a crew of 3 technicians to spend half a day, including travel time, to fix the problem, I would lose the gross profit of almost 3.5 weeks of production when I factored in the cost of the callback and the cost of the lost production that the crew could not produce. And there are other expenses. There's the time it takes to respond to the customer and set up the callback. There will be increased back office costs to track the additional paperwork associated with the callback. There could be a delay in cash flow if the customer refuses to pay until the callback work is done. There might even be a billing reduction to buy back the customer's goodwill. In the worst case, the customer discovers the problem. This can result in additional costs, including the time to respond to and investigate the complaint. And if the customer badmouths the company, it could result in lost potential referrals, which could drive increased marketing costs to make up for the lost referral business. And there can be a lowering of morale for everyone in the company, which will have an effect on performance. So, what do you do if quality issues, such as callbacks and inefficient business operations, are affecting your bottom line? How do you make up for the lost profit? Well, you could sell more jobs to increase sales, but that might require a larger marketing expense and more overhead to manage the additional job load. You could increase prices, but that might make you less competitive in the marketplace. You could reduce costs by using less expensive materials, but they come with their own quality risks. You could reduce labor costs by replacing more highly paid employees with lower paid and most likely less experienced employees, but that also increases quality problems. All these strategies have the feel of winning the battle but losing the war. Or you could focus on improving the quality of your goods and services, which, if done right, will result in lower costs and increased productivity and a larger bottom line. To do that, you need to install or create a quality management system for your business. Virtually all quality management systems focus on four critical success factors for creating a quality organization: a focus on process and error prevention, strong, committed leadership, a motivated, committed workforce, and an organizational culture that supports quality. The first step in addressing quality problems in your business is to understand how your business actually works. All businesses operate by using processes. A process is everything that happens in your business to achieve an end that can be described as a sequence of steps where the steps are interdependent and linked, with each step serving as the input for the next step. Additionally, a process always has a known goal or end result. So, in my go-to-work process, I wake up, take a shower and shave, get dressed, have breakfast, check my email, get in my car, and drive to work. However, if I said that what I do every day is I wake up, drive to work, have breakfast, get in my car, get dressed, take a shower and shave, and then check my email, I would not be describing a process. The steps are all there, but they are not interdependent, and they are not connected, and there's no clear goal or end result. Everything that goes on in a business can be described as a process or a series of processes, and all processes have variation. There are two kinds of variation in business processes: common cause variation and special cause variation. Common cause variation is just the normal variation in the way things are done. It's the variation that occurs when nothing goes wrong, and it's a design issue. On the other hand, special cause variation is variation that occurs when something does go wrong and the process breaks down. It's an operations issue. Here are some examples. In an office with 10 people, there's a single commercial printer. Everyone sends their printing requests to the printer and waits for the project to print. In addition, each time the printer runs, the person whose print job is being printed has to get up, go to the printer, retrieve their job, and go back to their desk. Sometimes the printer gets behind and people have to wait for their jobs to get printed. One of the employees in the office made a suggestion to management to replace the single large commercial printer with inexpensive desktop printers at every desk. The result was a dramatic increase in productivity. The printing process was redesigned. That's a true story. Well, here's another more theoretical example. I drive to work every day using the same route. It takes me 27 to 33 minutes to get to work, depending on lights and traffic, for an average of 30 minutes each way. That range of time, 27 to 33 minutes, that is common cause variation. One day I decide to take a different route to work, and after a week I discover that the trip now takes between 23 and 27 minutes for an average of 25 minutes each way. That translates to 5 minutes saved per trip, or 10 minutes per day, or 50 minutes per week, or 2,500 minutes per year, assuming I work 50 weeks per year. That's almost 42 hours a year, or more than a full week of additional productive time if I leave home and work the same time every day before and after making the route change. And it occurred by redesigning the process of driving to work. However, if I get a flat while driving to work, that's special cause variation. It's not a problem with the design of driving to work, but with the operation of driving to work. I was an insulation contractor for more than 25 years, specializing in retrofitting existing houses. In my business, examples of common cause variation included the time it took to process a contract and get it scheduled, the time it took to stage the materials for a job and load the trucks, the time it took to set the job up at the job site, the time it took to complete the job, the time it took to complete the service order and get a bill to the homeowner. On the other hand, I experience lots of special cause variation over the course of the years, including missing tools and/or equipment at the job site because they were left at the previous job, wrong materials at the job site, missed areas of the house because the estimator didn't provide sufficient details in the diagram accompanying the contract, wrong settings on the insulation blowing machine, resulting in cracked sheetrock from overpressurizing the walls during wall insulation, technicians working in attics and stepping off joists and through sheetrock and plaster ceilings. Believe me, this is just a partial list. There are savings and efficiencies to be gained by both improving the design of business operations and reducing or eliminating breakdowns in business operations. Because special cause variation is more obvious and can result in significant costs, it should be tackled first. Breakdowns are easier to identify and analyze than the processes that underlie common cause variation, and if they are not addressed, they can make the analyzing common cause variation more difficult. So, what is your response when something goes wrong? There are generally three classes of responses to breakdowns. The first is just fix it and move on. The second is to find someone to blame. And the third is to fix the problem, but take the time and effort to uncover the root cause of the problem. Sending a technician or crew out to address the problem and moving on will solve the immediate problem, but will not prevent the problem from happening again. Fixing the problem and then finding someone to blame not only doesn't prevent the problem from happening again, but it can have very negative consequences for the culture and performance of the company. I will have more to say about blame as a management tool later in the podcast. The first step in moving away from a blame culture is to change the language around breakdowns. Instead of couching discussions about the breakdown in terms of good and bad or right or wrong, it's much more useful to speak in terms of what's working and what's not working. That takes the moral judgment out of the conversation while still addressing the problem. The second step is to actually find the root cause of the problem. Root cause analysis is a central tool in the quality management toolbox. It's based on the idea that when something goes wrong in an organization, the ultimate cause of the problem, more often than not, lies in a process that is not working. The breakdown is in the process, not the person. Fix the process and prevent the problem from reoccurring, and it only works in a blame-free culture. There are several tools for conducting root cause analysis, including flowcharting, fishbone diagrams, also called Ishikawa diagrams, fault tree analysis, and five whys. There isn't time in this talk to explain all these techniques, but I will focus on the simplest and maybe most effective one, five whys. Here's how it works. When something goes wrong, you ask why. Whatever answer you get, you keep asking why until you reach the root cause, which is most likely a breakdown in a process. My wife worked for years for Carrier Corporation as a documentation clerk in the engineering department, and she told me the engineers used five whys often to diagnose why some process or piece of equipment was not working as designed. Here's an example of the methodology to analyze an event which I confess took place in my own business. A recently hired technician damaged the interior sheetrock of an outside wall while installing blown-in wood fiber cellulose. Why? Because he didn't set the gate and blower speed correctly on the insulation blowing machine, and he overpressurized the wall. Why? Because he didn't receive sufficient training. Why? Because there was no one to train him properly. Why? Because the company didn't have a formal training program in place. Why? Because the company grew so quickly that there was no time to set up a formal training program for new hires, and it was all hands on deck to get the jobs done. You can use 5Whys to analyze virtually any process in your life. For example, in my personal life, for years, I would never, ever remember where I parked my car when I went shopping in a place with a large parking lot, and would spend wasted minutes wandering around to find my car after completing my shopping. I actually did a 5Whys on myself and figured out that I really didn't like shopping, and I was so focused on just getting in and out of whatever store I was going to that I literally paid no attention to where I parked my car. Whatever efficiency I gained in my single-minded focus on the shopping was completely lost when I had to search for my car in the parking lot. So I changed my process so that when I got out of my car now, I look around and find a reference point to locate my car like a sign on the building. The few seconds it takes me to get that reference point saves me sometimes minutes of looking for my car. I redesigned my shopping process. Once you've completed the root cause analysis and have an understanding of the process breakdown that underlies your problem, the next step is to modify the process to prevent the problem from happening again. It could involve instituting training or the creation of checklists, among other actions. Put the plan into action and monitor the results over time. If it works, institutionalize the new procedures so everyone in the company understands the new protocols. If it doesn't, modify the procedures and go through this cycle of plan, do, check, act until the problem is permanently eliminated. While there's a cost to all this, the ultimate benefits should outweigh the cost of continuing to have the breakdowns. The second characteristic of a successful quality management system is strong, committed leadership. In the absence of leadership, improvement will never happen. The most critical role of the leader is to create a clear vision of the purpose or mission of the organization and create an internal environment in which all employees can share in that vision. It's critical for the leader to create systems that encourage information flow from all directions, up, down, and laterally within the organization. Management must develop the ability to listen effectively to what employees have to say. When the employees understand the importance of their contribution to the success of the organization, they will bring commitment and creativity to the workplace. Studies have shown that the single biggest cause of failure to sustain quality improvements in companies is the lack of buy-in and participation of employees in the process. Buy-in cannot happen in an atmosphere of blame. Blame is a management tool, changes behavior but doesn't change values. It shows up as punishment and creates a culture of following and not leading. It kills independence and discourages cooperation and feedback. To avoid the shame that accompanies blame, employees will hide mistakes. The damage to the reputation of a company is significantly greater when the customer finds the mistake than when the company finds the mistake. One of the ways that operations are improved in a company is through the creative thinking that engaged and committed employees bring to the organization, especially employees who are in the front line of production. Blame discourages creative thinking in the staff, which could actually improve operations. Finally, blame undermines morale, which almost always lowers productivity. So the relationship between management and staff should be one of partnership. A study was done on why employees don't do what's expected of them. The top three reasons found were they didn't clearly know what was expected of them, they didn't know how to do it, and they didn't know why they should do it. In all three cases, the issue was due to a breakdown in process, not a personal failing of the employee. The final leg of a quality management system is an organizational culture that incorporates quality into its structure. In some ways, this is the most difficult part of developing a quality organization. Culture is loosely defined as the way we do things around here, and is the system of shared values that defines what's important to the organization. It's the norms that direct the appropriate attitudes and behaviors of the members of the organization, and it's really hard to change. John Cotter, a leading expert on change management and professor at Harvard University, has studied the process of organizational change and has created an 8-step process for creating change within an organization. It starts with creating a sense of urgency. That sense of urgency can only come from leadership at the top of the organization. It can be driven by outside forces, such as the challenge of an aggressive competitor, or by internal forces, such as quality issues causing significant profit and customer losses. The second step of the process is to create a guiding coalition of managers and staff from which the organization who are committed to the change. The third step is for the guiding coalition to create a change vision that will guide the process. This might include soliciting input from all company employees. Step four is to communicate the vision and get buy-in from the stakeholders in the organization, including employees and even vendors. The fifth step is to empower broad-based action, which also involves empowering staff at all levels to contribute to the change. The sixth step, which is critical, is to generate short-term wins. Swinging for the fences rarely works, and its failure will cause the change momentum to slow and possibly stop. Short-term wins preserve momentum and keep the change process going. The seventh step is to not declare victory too soon. Declaring victory before the vision is actually realized can result in loss of momentum and backsliding. Finally, the eighth step is to incorporate the change into the culture so it becomes the new way we do things around here. What Cotter says is that culture change takes time. For a small company, it could take 6 months to a year. For a larger company, even longer. But if done successfully, the benefits of the change will be long-lasting and permanent.
As always, we welcome your feedback on each month's presentation. Please feel free to give us a call at 877-202-8891. The vision of Grandy & Associates is quite simple. We teach companies how to run profitable businesses. For more information on how we do that, check out our website at www.grandyassociates.com or give us a call at 1-877-202-8891. Profit University Audio Series is produced and distributed by Grandy & Associates. If we can be of service to you, give us a call on our toll-free line at 1-877-202-8891. Until next month, remember, invest your time and invest your money in those things that will reproduce.